Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited. I have a guest, Victoria Nelson. She has written a book called Gothica, and at last, someone has written a book that explains to me the video games, the horror novels, all of the comic books and graphic novels, the Hellboys. You know, I've been there for Chris Ware or Art Spiegelman, but this is the superhero stuff. And she sees it as a reading of the culture and what it's like to be alive and young and what it's like to be scared. And it's the most exciting work of criticism I've read maybe in 15 years. So here she is. How did you start? I mean, you're the queen of the Gothic.
Well, all true passionate writing kind of comes out of your own deep interests. And as a child, I know I always loved ghost stories. I didn't get to read horror comics when I was a kid because my parents belonged to that generation that believed that Dr. Vertum knew what he was talking about and you shouldn't expose your children to violent comics. So my brother and I read Donald Duck and we read Classics Illustrated Comics, and that was kind of our fare. But I discovered ghost stories and loved them and still love them very much. I will say, just to be totally honest, that I don't care for vampires or zombies. Zombies make me very anxious. Vampires, I don't really thrill to. But as I got deeper and deeper and deeper into this question of the supernatural and its very peculiar position in our culture, these were the stories that I really, really wanted to look into deeply.
Well, it fascinated me because you find that vampires and zombies are the representative characters now. You trace their family lives. I mean, I didn't know anything about the Hellboys. I'm so sorry, but now I want to learn every spawn imaginable. It isn't literature, but it seems to offer you a kind of vitality that literature once had. Am I getting this right?
Well, I think there's always been story, you know, and all of these artifacts of popular culture that used to be called lowbrow, that, you know, educated people really don't read past the age of about 13 or 14, are part of this older tradition of storytelling, primal storytelling, and that taps into the central nervous system of every human being. It's something you can't get away from.
Maybe, you know, talk got too full of lies, and so zombies become really meaningful creatures, you know, striding away the way we used to like to think of doing during the counterculture, striding away from the mainstream, not answering.
Well, zombies and vampires are surely outcast figures. I mean, that's an essential component, so that the rebel teenager is going to want to identify with a dark side that his parents are not going to approve of. That's the kind of ancient, time-honored tradition of adolescent initiation. But these stories have to do with the need of young people to find a world and a dimensionality that's larger than the realist and the naturalistic. I think that's a deep craving. And since the 60s, young people have more and more and more moved into fantasy and science fiction as their default mode of literature. And as you and I have mentioned, it's not literature on a sentence-by-sentence basis that we love and appreciate. It's not Henry James. It's not a great stylist tour de force. But it feeds a need that I feel is not particularly literary. It's something else.
Well, you had said to me that the zombie for you is the child who imagines the grid going down and the cell phone no longer working, that it is the new post-technological autism. And I thought, that's fascinating.
Well, actually, that's a wonderful phrase, and I think you've coined it. I don't think I said that. But it's not the zombie, but it's the thought of being the young person who's facing a world where society has failed them and society is collapsing, the infrastructure is going, everyone is going to rely on himself. It's been a big challenge to make the zombie into a sympathetic eye voice narrator, but it's happening. In the meantime, I think it's these, particularly the millennials, if you remember the weird celebration that went on when Osama bin Laden was killed, these college kids were out partying until 2 and 3 a.m., and the rest of us were scratching our heads until it was pointed out that Osama bin Laden was their Hitler. Like, they were all 9 or 10 when 9/11 happened, and this boogeyman and this warfare had been ravaging for the rest of their lives. And so I think the 9/11 generation in particular is attracted to zombies because of that genre's comment on warfare, on soldiering, on collapse of social infrastructure, that kind of thing.
And you say that the pictures of the soldiers in Afghanistan, that the body armor is part of the fascination of the monster.
Yes, I think the translation of the superheroes of the 70s, 80s, and 90s onto the big screen, mainstream, high-budget, global superhero movies that go all over the world, and you take someone like Iron Man, who's just grotesquely armored. I do think also that's something that goes along. Zombies, superheroes both go along with a kind of martial dimension in a culture when it's rising to the surface.
But in the sub-zeitgeist of global culture, you talk about how those movies, those tentpole movies, give way all over the globe to other cultures attempting to imitate them on smaller scales with one name actor, and that suddenly, at the same time as we're seeing these imperialist movies about superheroes, we're seeing from Japan and from Africa and from Korea another set of commentary movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we really are at the peak of imperial influence in terms of pop culture and these kinds of movies. Japan, long ago, for the last 20 years, Japan has basically taken over from the U.S. With everything from Pokemon to, all of the horror movies. It's just, they've just flooded popular culture to the point where American versions of Japanese manga comics come out and you have to read them back to front like Japanese, and there's not the slightest attempt to assimilate into American culture. They keep in the cartoons, they keep the Japanese characters on the shop signs and so on, which is a very telling sign. And then beyond that, all of the Asian cultures, there's this fabulous Thai martial arts series called Ong Bak that's tremendously popular. And they're coming back, they're taking the genres, they're making them into something of their own. And ultimately, other cultures than ours will be the touchstones for global popular culture. Basically, we're looking at the peak and the end, in my opinion.
It's fascinating to me because you point out that vampires are not traditional to English culture or American culture, that they come, do I have it right, from Russia and Greece.
South Slavic, or Serbia, the Balkan Peninsula, parts of Poland, and Greece, yes.
They become fascinating to the English. They travel to America, and now, of course, we have Japanese vampires. And what happens to these figures of terror as they enter cultures where they're not native?
Well, often what happens is that there's some indigenous folklore that has some kind of monster or other that may or may not suck blood. And these, the older indigenous one fuses with the vampire. There's a series, manga, Japanese series called Blood, and that was then turned into a feature film and then American feature film, in which this is a fascinating story. It's a young woman, a vampire, who is brought to an American Air Force base in the 70s during the Vietnam War to investigate murders. And so she uncovers all kinds of things, and then ultimately she has a fight to the death with her mother, who is the kind of queen vampire, but they're called demon and vampire interchangeably, the old word, Japanese word, and the imported word. And then the daughter finally finishes off the mother, and the mother's parting words are, "Do you think you're any better than I am?"
Oh, wow. I'm talking to Victoria Nelson, and to be honest, I think you can tell this. I want to be talking to her forever. She's written a book called Gothica, and it's a book which gave me a cultural context for the comics, the manga, the arrival into the culture of death rock, of autism as a popular form of bloodlust. I felt as if I was understanding what has happened to my culture and that my head had been, you know, like buried down an ostrich hole, because this is where the information, the reflection of the culture is occurring.
Yes, I think it happens on all kinds of levels, and I've always been a proponent of the trickle-up effect as opposed to the trickle-down effect of cultural influence. But I don't think it means necessarily that serious, quote-unquote, literature is dead and gone by any means. I think it's a very rich river that has always flowed upwards in terms of influencing writers whom we regard as, you know, the sort of lasting masters and so on. I mean, there's quite a lot of similarity between Emersonian transcendentalism and some of the wonder tales of the early 19th century, even you could argue Poe, and Mormonism, and all kinds of other things are mixed together. They're all part of a matrix. There's not really a high and a low.
Sometimes they move from one to the other. When I learned how to pronounce the name Thulu, am I doing it right?
Clulu.
Clulu. These are the monster elders in the Lovecraft tales. And they seem to have, in addition to being under the ground, as so much of this literature has an underworld, they've moved, it seems, culturally, through every level, not just in our culture, but in global culture, from low to middle to high, to music. Tell me about Lovecraft and when you found him, because he's at the origin of this study.
Yes, very much so. And I did not come to Lovecraft as a teenager, as most great Lovecraft fans do, and it's a very gendered readership of primarily male, sensitive male adolescents. There's a whole syndrome, and many of them grow up to be scholars for some reason or other. And when I first read Lovecraft as a grown adult, I just kind of gagged on the style. It just seemed very over the top. And then a funny thing happened. As I kept reading Lovecraft, I kind of drank the Kool-Aid, I guess you'd say. There's something in his style that sucks you in completely. It's not just that he's invented a whole kind of cosmos of creatures and so on. It's the style itself, the sentences themselves that are very, very hypnotic. And so you find Lovecraft scholars are very much like James Joyce scholars. They start imitating the master. And so when you read Lovecraft criticism, you feel like you're reading Lovecraft because they write the same way.
It is immersion. And you have to be willing to immerse in very unpleasant things. Lovecraft was the first writer I knew of for sure who wanted to describe things with the texture of phlegm or pus. And, you know, I'm kind of going, well, I don't know. But before you know it, those things were the great triumph of special effects departments who were making out of rubber cement things you would never want to encounter in the corner of your room. And, you know, more and more slime.
Right.
And viscera.
Big on slime.
Yes. And you see, so it became almost as if there was a counterculture in terms of good taste. Let's get rid of it. Let's find out the things that make our flesh crawl. Why is having the flesh crawl an agreeable sensation?
Yeah, what you're saying reminds me of Edmund Wilson's famous remark that the only horror in Lovecraft was the horror of bad taste. it's agreeable, and I think to a certain extent it's a compulsive pleasure. It's a pleasure that people are drawn to repeat over and over and over again. The pleasure or unpleasure of being terrified. That's the kind of bottom line sensation of a horror story. And I guess what I've come to think about it really is that this kind of repetition compulsions, I talk about it a little bit in The Secret Life of Puppets, is to be very psychological, and this is not the complete story by any means, but on the psychological level, it's the attempt to master old trauma and by feeling that feeling again. And when you read a horror story, the feelings get aroused, but then in a very ritualistic and formal way or formulistic way, they get worked out and it's done, but it's not resolved. And so what you're left with is the need to read it all over again and get scared all over again with the hope of mastery that never comes. So the contrast to that, the example that I always use is that when you read Kafka's Metamorphosis, you have an experience of suffering and dread and terror that's infused with empathy, among other things. It's a journey. A journey into a kind of shared experience, if that's the right way to put it. When you finish reading Metamorphosis, you do not have a burning compulsion to go out and read another story like it, because that artist has somehow recreated what's going on in a much more meaningful and non-formulaic way. Whereas if you go to the drive-in and you see Attack of the Flying Insects, on the big screen, you watch it, you go through it, and then the next time, you know, Attack of the Flying Slimoids comes, then you're there to see it again and to go through that never quite completed ritual.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Victoria Nelson about her nonfiction book, Gothica, Vampire Heroes, Human Gods, and the New Supernatural. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Victoria Nelson about Gothica. She writes about the rise of the supernatural into mainstream popular culture. Vampires and werewolves, no longer monsters, have become heroes. What I loved about this book, there's a strong implication throughout it that the experience of terror is a kind of ecstasy.
Yes.
And that the ecstatic experience is a spiritual experience. And that the reason why these figures, this music, these comic books, these movies are coming up is part of the search for a new religion.
Yes, yes. Very much so. And many, many fans have written about or spoken to the fact that they discovered religion or spirituality through horror, through monsters, through all of these kinds of movies and novels and graphic novels. And I feel there's a very specific historical reason for that in our culture, which is that after the Protestant Reformation, the supernatural basically, and along with the scientific revolution at the same time, Western culture moved into a very secular, empirical, rationalist mainstream in which, apart from organized religion, which was then kind of ghettoized to a separate category because organized religion could no longer describe the natural world, science completely took that over. So the only thing left in the kind of Protestant worldview was this notion that anything uncanny was the devil's work and belonged to the dark side. So as a result, the sort of secular literature that developed within the Gothic and as it unfolded through the 19th and 20th century is the only supernatural you can get in your reading is dark, ugly, monstrous, horror, terror, et cetera, et cetera. So in this very natural way that people keep reinventing religion for themselves in a way that makes sense to them, the later generations started, they're looking for the supernatural. It's like heat-seeking missiles. So they go to this stuff, which is the most available thing in our culture, and out of it, they start to construct these little cults and religions. Well, pretty soon, the dark side gets to feel rather claustrophobic. And so I believe that's one of the big sort of unconscious movements of this subzeitgeist is out of the dark and into brighter, more heterogeneous form of gods, if you like, and spirituality. And it's no surprise that the vampires start to turn into gods. You know, they have to. They have to accommodate this religious sensibility.
Well, it's so moving because as I was reading your book, Gothica, I thought of a conversation that I just had a few weeks ago with Jeanette Winterson, the British writer, mm-hmm. who wrote about how, discovering that she was lesbian, her mother had her exorcised. And the whole community is there, putting their hands on her, screaming the demon out of her. And she says that the result, beyond the trauma, was the development of a radical kind of self-confidence that says anything inside me is mine. It's not the devil. It's not anything else. It belongs to me, and it's my sacred religion, you know? And that's an astonishing, you know, act of affirmation. Mm-hmm. And I think that after the whole culture that rose around the film The Exorcist and the arrival of the devil into culture again, full throttle, that, you know, defeating him and having the internal space free for the God inside has become the new religion, or at least I learned that in your book.
Well, Michael, that was very well put, and it puts me to mind, of course, of all of the graphic novel heroes of the 90s who are half devil and half human, and they are the heroes. So it's turning the devil really on its head, his head, to make the new heroes have their origins in this demonic space, but they're not the devil, and they're not something to be exorcised. They have merged with the human.
Yes, and that's the essence of Twilight, that the human now has joined the transcendent and has gone beyond the vampire stage into the universe. She's twinkling like stars. She's experiencing levels of pain that only vampires could stand, but humans, you know, have shirked, and there she is, a kind of, you know, astral body.
Yes, yes, a goddess.
A goddess. It's been lovely to talk to you, Victoria, and I hope it will be the first of many times.
I hope so, too.
Thank you. I've been talking with Victoria Nelson, author most recently of Gothica, Vampire Heroes, Human Gods, and the New Supernatural, published by Harvard University Press. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. In fact, while you're there, why don't you let me know about your favorite gothic, graphic novel, horror movie? I'd love to be hearing what you're looking at and what you like. That would be fun. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jim Crusoe is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.